Clear prop.
Star 73, Cherokee number 2, following Flynn traffic, 3 mile final. Clear Sussex. 1 Charlie Bravo, Lakeford runway 25, going 4 mile final.
This is Behind the Prop with United Flight Systems owner and licensed pilot Bobby Doss, and its co-host, Major Airline Captain and designated pilot examiner Wally Mulhern. Now let's go Behind the Prop.
What's up, Wally?
Hey, Bobby, how are you?
I am fantastic as always. Took our first week off last week. Felt weird. Felt like I was letting people down or something. I don't know. But both of us had Father's Day plans. Both of us had big weeks before that. And we had a plan to record and just kept slipping and kept slipping. So hopefully you liked the replay of Tammy Jo Schultz, a local aviator in Texas here that had a big day. So we did our first replay, and we're excited to be back for sure. So this week we're going to talk about the top eight reasons why people are unsuccessful on private pilot check rides. This is all about not being probably prepared or proficient or ACS ready for a check ride. Wally, you've now done upwards of 600 or 700 check rides, I believe. I think your pass rate's somewhere in the low 90s, high 80s. So out of 600 or 700, 60 or 70 of them haven't been successful. And we're going to go through some of the reasons for you and some of the reasons just from the DP community that has been shared with us. Are you ready to go?
Yes, sir.
All right. We're going to do this kind of like these young kids might not know who David Letterman is, but we're going to go in backwards order here, starting with 8, which we think is, out of all the failure reasons or all the discontinuance reasons, this is the least likely one for you, but one that happens on a regular basis, and that is airspace. Talk a little bit about airspace, Wally, and where students are missing the mark and what you see on a regular basis when you do check rides.
Yeah, I think airspace is intimidating to everybody. I mean, you look at this upside down wedding cake and you see A, B, C, D, E, F, or no F, but E and G airspace, and you know, it is a little bit intimidating. And what I have found is that the applicants who fly in more complex airspace are better at airspace than the applicants who don't fly in more complex airspace. Kind of a novel concept. Someone who plays golf a whole lot is better at playing golf than someone who doesn't play golf a whole lot, for the most part. I had a gentleman for a check ride, maybe 6 months ago. A very, very successful 50-some-odd-year-old gentleman, had a very technical career, was very successful at it. So on the surface, you would say a smart man. And he was. We did the ground portion, and he did a very good job. And we were taking off out of an uncontrolled airport, and we were right on the edge of the 30-mile ring around the Class B airspace. So if you go 2 miles to the north, you're out of the Bravo, out from underneath it, and you never have to talk to anybody. And so we started out on the cross-country flight, and we got to the diversion portion. And the airport that made the most sense to divert to was a Class D airport. And this guy wanted nothing to do with going into Conroe, Texas, and doing a touch and go. He was totally intimidated by talking to Tower and telling him that we wanted to come in. And we ended up going in there, and he did all right. We did a touch and go, and then we went out and got out of their way and did all our maneuvers and everything. And during the debrief, he admitted to me that, well, I've hardly ever done that. And I said, well, maybe you need to do that. And it was, you know, he learned a lot from that, and he did okay. He could have done better, but he did satisfactorily. So, you know, it is just a factor of, you know, if you don't do it, you're not very good at anything. Just such a simple concept. But I do find that the students that we have at our local airport, David Wayne Hooks, which is a Class D airport, has a tower. It's located right beneath a 2,000-foot shelf of Class B airspace. By and large, these students are pretty good at knowing their airspace. I can't think of any, you know, because we spend a lot of time talking about airspace in the ground portion. And the way I do it, I mean, it's not like we say, okay, let's spend the next 10 minutes talking about airspace. We sprinkle airspace all throughout the entire portion of the cross country because we talk about a cross country flight. We're going to take off from here. Okay, what kind of airspace? What are the weather requirements here? Okay, if we go along and all of a sudden we decide to go to that airport, what kind of airspace is that? Well, it's Class C airspace. Okay, well, what are the weather requirements for that? So the airspace element of on the oral is really sprinkled throughout the check ride.
Well, and I mean, I obviously learned how to fly at this airport, and airspace was something that I was aware of, but I don't think I was good because I worked at this airport. I flew with CFIs who were afraid of breaking airspace, who made it very clear to me, don't let this happen. And it wasn't just knowledge, it was muscle memory of don't break 2,000 feet, don't get above 3,000 feet here, know these landmarks, know this GPS signal, and what the screen's telling us about airspace. So, I mean, it was literally living in it. And I don't know what it would be like to be at a Gulf airport all day, every day, and really just have to make my anonymous calls into the ethos of airspace, you know? So, It is different. I would say go practice. I don't think you can do it on a flight simulator or do it in a chair flying exercise. I think you got to go live in the environment for sure.
And I think as far as knowing your airspace, know what your go-to reference is when you have a question about airspace. I've been doing this a long time, and there are times that I go, class such and such airspace at night, is that 3 miles or is that 5 miles? But I know where to look for it. I know right where to go to look it up. So you know, you are probably going to memorize these things, but every once in a while you're going to have a little bit of a brain dump, and just be able to know where to go to.
Good tip. Number seven. Weather. We all love weather. Boy, actually, I hated weather. I still don't know if I like studying about weather, but weather theory's tough. Looking out, knowing there's thunderstorms and I'm not going to fly is not that tough. Talk a little bit about where we go wrong with weather or where students go wrong with weather.
Yeah, the thing that I feel that is important, excuse me, I try to you know, when I give a check ride, I try to make it to be practical. You know, I'm not going to ask them, I'm giving something away. I'm not going to ask anybody how long the propeller on the airplane is, whether it's a 78-inch or an 82-inch Hartzell or whatever. I'm not going to ask that, okay? So there's a little tidbit for my check rides. Because it just doesn't make a difference. But what I do think makes a difference as far as weather is concerned is understanding local weather. You know, now if someone comes from Seattle, Washington, down to Houston to take a check ride, you know, I'm not going to hammer them on Gulf Coast weather. But I will ask them about mountain flying. But, you know, I like to ask people just practical things about weather. I love being in places where the room that we're doing the ground portion of the check ride in has a window. And I love saying to the applicant, well, what's the weather outside? And I love just seeing whether, A, they either look out the window, or B, they look down at their electronic device and give me something. And what I like, I like when they look out the window. You know, how's the weather today? Oh, it's pretty good. I will, if somebody is maybe struggling with the practicality of weather, sometimes I will, if we're in a room that's completely enclosed, which most of them are, I'll take them outside and I'll say, hey, okay, let's walk outside right now. And I'll say, okay, what do you think the temperature is? And most of the time they get her pretty close. And I'll say, okay, where do you think, or what do you think the cloud coverage is? Is it scattered? Is it broken? Is it overcast? Most of the time they're right. I'll say, what do you think the wind is? Most of the time they're right. So my point is that we know more about weather than we think we know about weather. If we're in a Gulf Coast community, which we are, we have the Gulf of Mexico just south of us, you know, if the wind is out of the south, we probably have moisture in the air, so we're probably going to have clouds. If the wind is out of the north, it may be dry air today, so it may be more of a clear, you know, no clouds in the air today. So those are the type things. And one thing I ask on every single check ride, whether it be private, commercial, instrument, every single check ride, I do ask about icing levels. And I would say most people struggle with this one. They usually get it, but it takes a while. It's really pretty simple. Take the temperature in Celsius. Temperature is 30 degrees Celsius. The standard lapse rate is 2 degrees per 1,000 feet. So 30 divided by 2 is 15. The freezing level in a standard atmosphere is 15,000 feet above the ground. And here we're basically sea level, so we could say that the freezing level is at 15,000 feet. If you're up at Denver, you got to add the 5,000 feet field elevation and say it's at 20,000 feet. But every single check ride, I ask that. Whether it be summertime, wintertime, I don't care. I'm going to ask. I'll pick an airport and I'll say, you know, what's the temperature in Waco, Texas right now? And they'll look and they'll say it's 36 degrees, and I'll say, okay, just for the heck of it, what's the freezing level? And I think they ought to be able to tell me about 18,000 feet. Yeah, now in the summertime, is it a factor for us in these airplanes? It's really not. But in the wintertime, when it's 12 degrees, yeah, 6,000 feet freezing level, is that a factor? Absolutely it is.
Yeah, I think I was afraid of being asked, like, what type of cloud is this? And these minutiae, small components of weather that don't really impact the pilot on a regular basis. And maybe that's something that you get when you're a CFI, but I think it is the basics that you're talking about, you know, preventing yourself from getting hurt, preventing the plane from getting bent, and making sure you're not flying into known really dangerous stuff, right? So, focus on those big components, and I think you're going to be in a better spot as it relates to weather. Number six, many conversations about this one, but how about checklist usage? Has anyone ever been unsuccessful because of a checklist?
Yeah. Checklist, you know, if you look in the ACS under the landing section, under the skills elements, the first line for every single landing is complete the appropriate checklist. And the only way to complete the appropriate checklist is to actually do the appropriate checklist. So, you know, a lot of people, we get in the pattern and we just forget to do checklists. And that's kind of a no-brainer for me, because we're setting up a precedent for, well, we don't really need to do the checklists. Well, we do need to do the checklists. And because we're not training you to fly this Warrior where there's not a whole lot on the landing checklist, but we are training you to fly single engine airplanes, because tomorrow or next week, next month, you may be flying a Bonanza that has a propeller that we have to deal with, has cowl flaps that we have to deal with, and what's really important is it's got a landing gear that we have to deal with. So we're trying to build muscle memory, habit patterns right now of doing a checklist every time.
And this goes back to the CFIs that are teaching these students, right? We need the CFIs out there to be doing this and enforcing this on an every flight basis, so that it does become muscle memory and it does become a de facto for the student, so that they're not going to get hurt down the road or forget to put the landing gear down for sure. Number five, systems. I know you don't want to give away all your secrets, but what are some of your go-tos on systems?
Yeah, we've done many episodes on systems, and there's a lot we can do better with systems, and it all goes back to the POH. That book, there's so much information in there, and what I think is important is knowing what's in there. Not so much knowing the information, but knowing what's in there. If you were going to spend some time studying a POH, maybe study the table of contents to just know what's in there. For instance, we're in an airplane that maybe we have an alternator failure today in our airplane. Well, what is the procedure for the alternator failure in this airplane? Is this an airplane where it basically just says, shut it off and go land? Or is this an airplane where we try to do a reset? Maybe we have a backup battery, some other electrical source in this airplane that we can access. So just knowing that kind of stuff, but the electrical system, I think, is something that's really, really important in these airplanes, because if we lose our electrical system, we're going to lose our ability to communicate, our ability to navigate. Depending on what kind of systems we have, we may lose our ability to put flaps down. We may have to do some sort of an alternate gear extension. And if we're in IMC weather conditions, it adds all kinds of other issues to it. Just understanding the engine, different symptoms of the engine, what a rough running engine really means. Are there troubleshooting things that we can do in the air, on the ground? I mean, obviously the easiest thing on the ground is to not put it in the air. I would say, of my unsatisfactory check rides, maybe 15% of them happen during the ground portion, and I would say 99.9% of those, there's a systems element to it that the applicant is not very competent in the systems side of the, of. They just don't know the systems, and they're really pretty simple in these airplanes. The systems are not hugely complex.
What about a tomato flames, or the things we've been taught by cheat sheets and CFIs to memorize required equipment? And do people struggle with nav lights not working during the day, and can we go or shouldn't we go? Is there any kind of systems stuff like that that comes up that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, and that's I ask that one quite a bit because depending on the day of the whether it's a morning or afternoon check ride, you know, the cross country that I give them, it's real time. You know, I tell them to plan the cross country 2 hours after the start of the check ride, so it's possible that our cross country could be taking off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and in all cases, I usually do ask. I ask about some sort of inoperative equipment, and nav lights comes up a lot. And quite honestly, I don't even know what a tomato flames means. I mean, I know what it's all about, but I don't know what all the letters mean myself. I just know where to access the information, and again, I've done this so many times that I know what is required, but I just reference the actual FAR rather than the tomato flames. But yeah, there's a little bit of confusion. You know, do we need a nav light during daytime operation? And you know, a lot of people will say no, and I'll say, okay, so what now? Do we just go out and go, or what? And there's some more things to do. You can't just say, hey, the nav lights don't work, but it's daytime, we don't need them, let's go. There's some more things that need to happen. And sometimes people struggle with that. They know that they don't need them, but and they usually find their way around, and they're usually okay with that.
Moving on to some harder things. That was the first half of the list, and now that's those things cost people their first check ride attempt, maybe. But these four are where we get into the heart of the difficult items. And the first one on this list now, the number four overall, is stalls. Man, Wally, when I first started flying, all I could think about was that metal machine I was in was going to fall out of the sky. I was scared. I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't know what the wings were doing. I thought one would break off. I was really a nervous flyer. So you can imagine when lesson three comes around and he wants to show me my first power off stall, man, all I knew was that means the wings aren't working and we're going to really crash. So it's got to be a point where everyone's a little bit nervous as they're learning how to fly. This is the private check ride. They've got 40 to 60 hours under their belt. What is the problem with the execution of stalls on a check ride?
Well, for the most part, what I say is, okay, let's do a power off stall as per the ACS. And I wish we would stop calling it a power off stall, and I wish we would start calling it a landing stall, because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to simulate coming in to land. We're pretending that maybe we're on base and we're turning final, and we get distracted and we get the nose up, and all of a sudden it's too slow and we stalled the airplane. So you know, a lot of times on a stall, a power off stall, the applicant will they'll usually clear the area, and they just flying straight and level, and then they'll just pull the power back and stall the airplane. Well, that's not the way the ACS says to do it. The ACS says to establish a descent, and then I believe it says a stabilized descent, and then you know, pull the nose up and stall the airplane. So so sometimes you see that is that they do it improperly. Is it wrong to do a stall that way? Well, if we're trying to do it as per the ACS, yeah, it's wrong. You know, are we learning how to do a stall? I think we probably are, but you know, just not establishing the descent is something that's very common. Now on a power on stall, What I see is very aggressive flying. In other words, okay, we push the power up, we slow it down to rotation speed, we push in full power, and then we just pull that nose up, and the pitch of the airplane is crazy high, and we stall and recover. And I can't say that that's wrong, but again, what we're trying to simulate is a takeoff here. And 15, 20 degrees nose high up in a 172, there's nothing that feels right about that. And all the senses are telling you, boy, this is wrong, this is wrong. So I would say just have a little bit more patience with it. You know, get the nose up to a normal pitch up. And we don't have to slow down at an extremely fast rate. Just slowly let the airplane slow down and get into a stall, because, again, that's what we're trying to simulate. We're trying to simulate taking off and maybe not paying attention to the airspeed, and all of a sudden we stall the airplane.
Yeah, I don't think I really had that concept figured out till I was doing my multi-engine training. I hate to admit that out loud to thousands and thousands of listeners, but the reality is in the twin, when I started doing that training, it's not a plane you can just pull back on and make it stall that fast, right? And you've actually got to let things develop. And the practice in that aircraft made me really understand. And as I've gone back to single engines and re-practiced in those, it's just almost like you pick a point in the sky. If there's a little puff of cloud out there somewhere that you can put the nose on it, if you just keep going at that rate, at some point it's going to give up and not be able to create lift and stall. And I just don't think I really understood that till I was working in my twin stuff. So the DP is not expecting this to occur within the first 15 seconds after they say, let's do a power off stall as per the ACS, right?
That's correct. Absolutely.
And I thought that was the expectation when I was training. I think from a training environment, you're with your CFI, the CFI's got another lesson coming, you go out to the practice area, you're trying to get as much in as you can. It was a boom, 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 boom kind of practice session. And as I look back, it wasn't really what the DPE was wanting me to do, and I felt this level of anxiety to hurry and get it done and make the plane stall instead of let the plane stall. And it's just not reality. As you said, the body feels that this is completely out of whack. Let's don't do this. And that's not how it's going to happen if it ever sneaks up and bites any of us.
That's an interesting what you just said. Let the airplane stall rather than make the airplane stall.
Alrighty, number three, the dreaded, what I call the parallel parking of private pilot check rides. It is the emergency landing.
Yeah. I would call this the parallel parking. You're going to have one of these, and you know, you need to come up with a plan. And you know, I'm going to go against what a lot of maybe even the checklists say. I would say one of the first things that happens, you know, when you lose an engine and you're going to put it down off the airport, one of the first things you want to do is let people know. Let people know, whether it's squawking 7700 or getting on the radio and letting people know that you have a problem. I mean, there have been many check rides that I've done where I think the person would be successful in putting the airplane on the ground, but they never told anybody. And I always say, okay, so we've landed out in the field, out in the middle of nowhere. Very possibly the airplane flips over and we survive, but we're knocked unconscious. And while we're knocked unconscious, some wild hogs come up and eat us. Okay, you know, what a horrible death. And all it would take is letting ATC know that you've got a problem via squawking 7700 or getting on the radio and talking. So, you know, factor that in. Everybody kind of puts that at the end of everything. Okay, I go through my, maybe my procedure, maybe my mixture, maybe my fuel switch, maybe my carb heat, primers in and locked, mags are on both. I've attempted a restart. It's not going to restart. Okay, now I'm going to aim for this field over here. You know, bottom line is we want to get the airplane on the ground and we want to call for help. And the most common thing is that they do all the first things, but they forget that let's call for help.
Yeah, and I don't remember the calling for help being, I mean, I think I mayday, mayday, mayday and did all that like it was part of my routine. I think it's so overwhelming that you have a seasoned veteran in the right seat. The CFI was obviously good at what they were doing, but you got somebody who's got 20,000 plus hours sitting next to you, who's got their maybe arms crossed and observing you as they should be. And you've got this one chance, right? There's no go arounds, as you could say here. And I just remember being overwhelmed with the fact that knowing it was coming, right? And that level of anxiety adds to it. But this is something that with practice you can get good at. You can learn the systems. You can learn the flows. You can follow the checklists and make it something that is something that you don't have to be afraid of and something that will make you really good if it ever does really quit spinning on you up there, for sure.
And it is absolutely something that you can get good at, and it takes practice. It's going back to the golfer. I mean, the more you practice this, the better you are. And you will, when you get down low, maybe you get down to 1,000 feet and you know, as you're practicing this, you know, that's a good point to say, oh boy, no, this was not a good choice. Yeah, I didn't notice this. Well, now you're down low. Now you kind of learned what power lines across a field might look like. So that might come into play next time. Okay, I'm not going to pick that because it looks like it might have power lines down there. So, yeah, I mean, this is something that you do need to practice.
The interesting fact that I think you've probably seen on Facebook or other social media sites is this image where there's a field and it's circled in like red on a picture, you know, from a cockpit from about 3,000 feet. And it says, my CFI has asked me to pick a place to land, and they're aiming for this circle. But just short of that circle is like three runways at a major airport, right? Student pilots are always looking. They start looking for a field. And that's something that innately gets really ingrained in your pilot methodology, that you just know where airports are at, right? And obviously EFBs have made that a big help, where you've kind of always got those in your line of sight, but it's interesting how many of us probably look at a field just on the other side of a perfectly good airport when we're rookie pilots, for sure. So we get from emergency landings and finding that spot and being safe to landings. Landings are number two on our list of top eight reasons why people are unsuccessful in their private pilot check rides. Where are we going wrong with landings on check rides, Wally?
Well, this can go back to a previous subject, and that's checklist usage. So, you know, this is kind of a dual thing. I mean, if we're going and we're doing all our landings and we're not doing the checklist, well, then the landings are not satisfactory. So, you know what you're going to get on a check ride, a private pilot check ride. You're going to get a short and soft field landing and take off. You're going to get a normal. You're going to get a slip to a landing. And you're going to get a go-around. And you know, at some point we're supposed to introduce a systems failure. So everybody knows that electrical failures are near and dear to my heart. So if we're in a electrically flap-operated airplane, most of my applicants are going to get a no-flap landing at some point in the whole check ride process. So just know that you always have in your back pocket a get-out-of-jail-free card, and that's called a go-around. Okay, so if you're coming in for your landing, it's a short field landing, and you're going to miss the spot by 800 feet, go around. Okay, we have to do a go-around anyway. And if you're coming in and you're not going to hit your spot and you go around, you know, that's like a feather in your cap. To me, that says, hey, first of all, we just checked the go-around off the box and you've shown me some good judgment. Now, at some point, we got to land. And you know, that's kind of at the discretion of the examiner. If we've done 17 go-arounds to try to do this short field landing, there might be a discussion that we need to have about maybe your short field landing abilities. But, you know, if the landing is not going to turn out the way you want it to do, be proactive and do something about it and go around.
All right, the big one, and this actually was my big one. And if you've been flying long, you may know what this next one is because we've skipped it so far. Number one is navigation. And boy, golly, I don't know why, but it was something about the 360-degree radial system. I just couldn't think through it. I knew what north, south, and east and west was, but I just really struggled with what bearing I was on, how to track the VOR. We spent a lot of time on it, and one day it just clicked. I'm sure everybody's had that moment where something that was difficult for them just clicked, but man, navigation was tough. And it's such a small, not the pilotage portion or the dead reckoning portion, but I'm thinking navigating with navigational equipment was such a small portion of the private pilot learning for me that I just struggled with it. Is that something you see people struggle with, Wally?
Yeah, I would say the pilotage and dead reckoning people do struggle with. You know, for a private pilot under Part 61, you're required to have 5 hours of solo cross-country. So that usually equates to two cross-country trips. So you just have not done this very much, okay? And most of our airplanes have some sort of a map display in it, whether it's a 430 or a 530 or a G1000, or for sure you've got your iPad and you've got your ability to display your own airplane on that. I think most examiners, me included, will have the applicant turn that ability off on your iPad. I'm not going to let you have your little airplane displayed on your iPad where you're just following a pink line. And I'm also going to, you know, cover up the map display. And the ACS is very, very, you know, it's right here on paper. It says navigate by pilotage. And what pilotage means is flying over a point on the ground and knowing where you are. And a lot of people struggle with that. It also says to prepare and use a flight log. Now, it doesn't say a paper flight log. So if you want to use the one that 4Flight comes up with, that suffices. Me personally, I think a paper one works better just because you can write that we were 1 minute early at our first checkpoint, so maybe the headwinds that we thought we were going to have aren't as strong, or the tailwinds are stronger, or whatever. So you can now make adjustments, where if you're in 4Flight, it's hard to make an adjustment on the screen. So navigate by pilotage, you know, learn what make good checkpoints. If we are, say, on an east-west cross-country, let's say we're going from west to east, a major north-south highway is probably not a good checkpoint, because you can be off by 20 or 30 degrees and you're still going to hit that major northwest highway. So you want something specific. You want a town, you want a the intersection of a road and a railroad track or something like that. You know, maybe try to stay away from bodies of water, because during a drought situation. That body of water may not be there. Maybe there have been a lot of rain, and so that body of water doesn't look like that body of water because it's flooded. It's over its banks, that sort of thing. So, it's a lost art. You know, just navigating via pilotage, it really is. We're just used to plugging it in and following the purple line, and but that's not what the ACS says that we need to do. So I think it is a lost art.
Yeah, I think we don't look out the window enough. We're so busy learning and trying to get better and looking at these magenta lines that we do forget to look out the window. I mean, most of us might navigate in a car, but we're really driving by road signs and history, right? We know what the Walmart looked like last time we went past it, and we're driving past it again. We know we're halfway to our destination. That's really what pilotage is in Dead Reckoning. It's a little bit more difficult in a three-dimensional space, but I do a lot of times put my iPad down and don't look and just fly to Austin because I know how to get there, and I know it should take me about 30 minutes when I'm flying over Brenham, and, you know, I look down and it's about 30 minutes since I left and I'm over Brenham's airport, right? That really is what it's like. Now, when you're got 10 hours of flight time, that's hard to believe that you're going to get to that point, but it's not that far off in the future. If you got 10 hours, trust me, you'll get there and you'll naturally have some of that in your system. Hopefully it'll be there on your check ride day so that you don't stub your toe and not pass that day. But navigation is very, very important. You know, lost procedures and being able to get to where you go or want to go is so, so important as a pilot that you can't shortchange yourself on that when you're learning how to fly for sure. Well, that's a good list of eight things, Wally. Anything else to add before we wrap up today?
No, I don't think so.
Come prepared, know the ACS, be ready for your check ride, log into IACR at least the day before so you know your password. Lots of little reasons why things slow Wally down on check ride day. Help him out, help all the DPAs out, and as always, fly safely and stay behind the prop.
Thanks for checking out the Behind the Prop podcast. Be sure to click subscribe and check us out online at behindtheprop.com. Behind the Prop is recorded in Houston, Texas. Creator and host is Bobby Doss. Co-host is Wally Mulhern. The show is for entertainment purposes only and is not meant to replace actual flight instruction. Thanks for listening, and remember, fly safe.